This story is from a series of connected stories, and it's called Silver Sculptures. There, he bottles enough fireflies to number in the dozens, enough to soothe each other while in captivity. He later deposits them behind the muslin partition in his studio, where they bear themselves. He watches their neon shadows dot exuberantly behind the billowing curtain. Within those first moments, they forget they want to flee rather than just zip around. And in the seconds that follow, they leave their lights on. The sculptor savors the display as one performed only for him, except that he created it. Circumstances have always bored him. He seeks rarefied models, electrostatic diagrams, and a consistent outline for the species. He ponders the concept of proportion as if it were always in vogue. More or less, he is like anybody. But in truth, at the root, he is like nobody at all. Once, at the turn of the century, he collaborated with a descendant of Christo to cover every spot of the continental United States of America with the largest piece of hand-stitched fabric in recorded history. The populace required adequate reassurance that they could continue going about their daily business. Many complained that the color should have been red or yellow or green or black rather than blue. Ultimately, most of them abandoned their protestations and periodically gazed up at the indigo sheath that undulated high above their heads and formed a geographically interstitial layer. The sculptor and his collaborator chartered legions of helicopters and hot air balloons, which they positioned along the eastern and western seaboards, forming a parenthesis around the country. Upon given the go-ahead, the vertical line of aircrafts along the east coast dove down to grab the blue blanket from the aluminum towers rooted along the coastline. With the airborne transfer a choreographic success on the east coast, the post along the west coast released their sections of cloth as well, and the balloon operators and helicopter pilots navigated eastward and upward to reach much greater altitudes. The squadrons flew toward the Atlantic Ocean, dragging the innumerable miles of fabric with them. As they did so, the legion of pilots along the left side of the country moved in the same direction, and their aerial camera crews filmed the entire event. The collaborative duo called the result of their experiment clearing the table, and they were satisfied. But the international orgasm of exposure that ensued sent the sculptor back to the roots of his solitary practice. He deduced that he had no business considering commercial contracts that catered to whatever industry attempted to associate itself with his endeavors. He became extremely disillusioned with the reporters and non-reporters who stationed themselves outside his cottage, ready with their microphones at all hours of the night in case something was about to happen. And he saw how sometimes what seems to be an axis is really an iceberg. People are still stockpiling sugar and gasoline. Every family home, whether in the city, suburbs, or rural areas, has a standard warehouse addition behind it. The structural appendage contains the same square footage of groceries, hygienic items, spare electronics, and seasonally appropriate clothing as the home itself. All of the megastores of yore are pictured in grade school textbooks as a sampling of the nation's entrepreneurial history. To think people used to drive all the way to a high-ceilinged store to stock their homes with the requisite goods, rather than simply open their warehouse door and wander the aisles of their own family inventory. To think there was a time when the pallet business contributed significantly less than one-tenth of the gross national product. It was part of the natural cycle of things. On a quarterly basis, every residence receives an automated message from its district's sustainability coach, reminding its residents to continue producing the requisite daily volume of household garbage. The recorded instruction ends with, And remember, waste is what lets us make fuel, which is what helps us power cars, trains, and aeroplanes. So you all want to keep moving, don't you? The sculptor's journey far, far north is not classified as a retreat. The town of Whitehorse is a destination, the site of his landmark, his masterwork. The northern lights are the sole necessity for realizing his vision. He identifies the frozen expanse of land that will serve as the approximate center point of his sculpture. He enlists a team of four bulldozers, which alternately stab, scrape, and scoop the snow-covered earth. Seated in an orange lawn chair, he fixates on the vehicles, which are fidgeting forward and backward with rotational precision. Hundreds of miles behind them, the strip of glitter-laden glaciers seduces his attention yet again. They had been part of the landscape of his initial investigations, his scoping of the Yukon Territory. Here, he wanted to drill down into the earth toward its impossible core. The swatches of sedimentary layers accumulate in 10 and 20 and 50 feet piles in front of him. The digging continues until finally, the sculptor signals to his assistants that the depth and circumference is sufficient. He can handle the rest. As the bulldozers exit the site one by one, the sculptor carries two of his shovels over to the nearest edge of the pit. He peers down into the crater, momentarily pained at the idea of permanently altering this landscape. It is not too much to bear, though. His own purpose rattles him defiantly, and half standing, now hunched over, he puts the larger shovel to use, carving at the edge of this cliff that he has created. He proceeds to shape the irregularities according to his sequence of plans, notes, and blueprints. Over the next 6 months, he and his team will be covering the entire crater with his patented formulation of pure liquid silver. When they finish, it will be his most magnificent work yet, a reverse sculpture that will mirror Whitehorse's Aurora Borealis back at the heavens. To accomplish the feat, his etchings into the perimeter of the cavernous hole in the earth must match the phenomena of the sky, or at least a version of its figurative condition. He continues on, a bit more intuitively, as his shoulders begin to ache, and he squashes globs of snow and mud, tossing it all aside. 80 minutes into his digging, clink, 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 the sculptor peels out a steel case that is the size of two shoeboxes. Among the items protected inside is an apparently photographic image, and I'll tell you that the photograph is of a large, elaborately drawn piece of graffiti that spells out the word grief. He empties out the newspaper clippings, photographs, binoculars, and plastic medallions, and there on the bottom of the container are the handwritten words, Anton Armour. It is a find, to be sure. After the sculptor finished his piece up north, he christened it Interstitial Armor, and now he is at work on a planetarium without a roof. He flattens out his project notebook and writes that all of the planets are pearls and that God wears the galaxy as a necklace. As his hand drifts across the page, a miniature mosquito bites his left thumb, then the right. Thank you.